Hey, everybody. I'm Ted Price from Insomniac Games. On this episode of the Game Maker's Notebook, I got a chance to sit down with Mary DeMarl and Jean-Francois Dugas of Eidos Montreal. Mary's the senior narrative director, and Jean-Francois is the senior creative director for the recently released and super entertaining Marvel's Guardians of the Galaxy game. We spent some time hearing about Mary's and Jean-Francois's beginning in the industry, and then we jumped right into how they and their team created the game. We talked at length about their wonderful characterizations of the Guardians and how they managed to weave story, dialogue, and design so seamlessly together. We discussed the evolution of their combat mechanics, the excellent music, and much, much more. And both Mary and Jean-Francois graciously shared some of their key learnings from production. Please join us.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
Francois, Mary, thank you so much for being on the show.
It's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
And I want to congratulate you on a super entertaining and engaging game with Guardians. I had a lot of fun playing. And we're going to talk plenty about it today. But I wanted to take a few steps back and ask you each a couple of questions about your own personal journey, if you don't mind.
Okay. Sounds good.
So Mary, did you always know you wanted to be a game writer?
I always knew I wanted to be a storyteller. Although I often tell the story that I knew I wanted to be a writer, but I was afraid. So I tried many different avenues first. So I tried film. I tried publishing. I stumbled into games, but as soon as I stumbled into games, it was where I knew that I really, really wanted to be, because the challenge of writing for games was unlike any other, in my opinion.
How did you stumble into games?
I was actually living in LA, and I had been working for several years. I'd worked for Hanna-Barbera, and I had worked for a small company that was making basically what we it was teaching through games. Okay. So they weren't actually games, but they were definitely like game-like productions that were teaching, you know, how to be a better salesman, stuff like that. And a college friend of mine was living in San Diego, and her boyfriend was a programmer working for a small studio, Presto Studios. Hmm. They made a series of games called the Journeyman Project. And they were looking for another game writer to join their team. And my friend knew that I wanted to write stories and things like that. So I ended up sending them like a chapter of an unfinished novel, and they hired me, and that's how it all started.
Oh, that's great. Wow. That is a blast from the past, hearing about Presto.
Yes.
But congratulations on entering that profession in games, because it seems to have evolved significantly. So, you know, having been a writer for so long in our industry, what do you think some of the key requirements are for being a successful writer in games today?
You definitely have to be flexible, and you have to be collaborative. You have to understand that, yes, you're shepherding a story along, but the story that you're creating is also being created by designers, by level artists, by gameplay people. And the primary thing you're focusing in on is the player fantasy through your story. All of which kind of means that you're not in charge of the story. You are, as the writer, you are, but you have to recognize that the journey will be under the player's control at all time, and you have to kind of just let it go.
That is great advice.
Thanks.
So, Jean-Francois, what was your journey like into the creative director role?
Well, it started as a kid. As a kid, I started to play games like in the late 70s, early 80s, and I fell in love with that. And with games. I was also big on movies, on big fantasy stories and stuff like that. When I was playing with my friends, I was the one setting up the rules, and because, like I was saying, my friends didn't know how to play in a structured way where we could have fun, because things would progress from the beginning, a middle to an end. And I was organizing sets of rules for my friends and I to have fun with, whether it was with toys or inventing sports or things like that, just as we were growing up and trying to enjoy ourselves with whatever we were into. And as I grew up older, in my teenage years, I was big, like one of my favorite series is Gabriel Knight, especially the first one, The Sins of the Fathers. And I was a big fan of Sierra Online Games and stuff like that. And I was, oh man, like, I wish I could be a game designer, creative director, whatever the role. But the funny part is that most of the companies, at least the ones I knew, they were American, and I didn't speak English at all. I'm French Canadian, so, and my English was like zero to none. And I was like, there's no way I will ever work in games. So I continued to study in sociology in university, and then I did a diploma in also in computer arts, mainly for pre-printing kind of magazines and Photoshop and all these kind of things. And there's a small company called Ubisoft that we heard in the news that they were installing themselves in Montreal, and it's a French company. And I was like, oh, like, is it real? And I remember to this day writing a letter of motivation to join the game industry without any scholarship in that field or any experience. And I was like, before starting to think about being a game designer or something like that, I need to get in the biz, like maybe QA, something like that, so I can learn and progress, and maybe have a chance to move up the ladder. And I wrote that motivation letter. And when I'm finished with that motivation letter, I reread myself and I start to laugh. I'm like, it's going to be one out of two things. It's either they will think I'm crazy and they will toss it away, or they will go, okay, this guy's passionate, let's give him a chance. And that's how it started.
So what was the position you joined at?
I started as a QA, a tester.
Oh, wow.
And it's funny, back then, like we're talking in the late 90s, as a QA, after a week, my boss said, you're going to be the lead QA for this project. And I'm like, okay, I have no experience of managing people, or even like I'm figuring out QA. And 2 months in, I'm offered my first gig as lead game designer on a Formula One racing game. And I was like, do you like racing games? I think they could have said anything and the answer would have been yes. And I fell in love with it, and I started my journey as a game designer and eventually becoming creative director for several years now. And yeah, that's all it started.
So one more question about creative directors. When people say, I want to be a creative director, what are a couple things you think they should know up front?
Well, your ego and what you think and your ideas don't matter as much as you think. Okay. And a bit like writing, like what Mary said, it's a question of like collaboration and understanding that you're not there to find the answers to everything, but you're there to make sure that you steer the boat to the right destination, like, because sometimes on the water a boat will go left, right, and if we let it slide too much to the left, too much to the right, I mean, you have a lot of experience yourself, you know that if we let that happen, games go in all directions and they never end, or they end up being average to mediocre games, and we cannot let that happen. So I would say that for me, one of the biggest skill is to understand the destination, make sure we stay on that target while remaining flexible and including all the people, talent and creativity in the mix. Like, it's not about you, it's about that energy that comes from the team.
That's a great description. Yeah, I love it. I hope many prospective creative directors are listening carefully to that. So you both teamed up on a fantastic game, Guardians of the Galaxy. And so I want to talk a little bit about, or ask you some questions about, just the beginnings. So how did the opportunity to create the game come up in the first place?
With David, our boss, I know he was pursuing that dream of working with a big partner like Marvel and everything. And eventually he approached us, Mary, myself, and a few other people, and said, like, we have a chance to collaborate with Marvel. And he asked us, like, with the franchises within Marvel, like, what we would love the best. And he already had his idea, but our idea was similar. We were like, we felt that Guardians of the Galaxy was a team of underdogs that that was fitting our personalities, was fitting our studio in some ways as well. Because I guess, like, every time when we were working on Deus Ex, like, nah, there's no chance they were going to make a good Deus Ex. Non-Guardians, there's no chance that Guardians will be good. So we feel like we're a bit those kind of underdogs. So we started with that franchise, and we got in it and got excited by the all the possibilities with it.
Well, when you made that decision to pursue Guardians or start working on Guardians, how did your initial brainstorming happen? How do you all do it there?
Read books.
Read tons and tons of comic books.
Okay.
I think one of the first philosophies that we have as a team, and definitely that JF as our creative director has instilled in us, is if you're going to work on something, you need to know the essence of what you're dealing with. And the first way to know the essence, especially for, you know, this huge topic of the Guardians of the Galaxy, is to dive into the comic books, read a lot of comic books, watch movies, watch the Guardians movies, but watch other movies as well, and play games and start thinking and letting the understanding of that group settle into our bones, so to speak, so that we can then start figuring out what the heck are we going to do with this.
And I think with what you just said, Mary, one of the things we do is we set the core values. What are the core values of the Guardians? Or even when we were working on Deus Ex, what are the core values that makes it Deus Ex? And even before starting to have ideas and start to design, for me, it's super important that you have a key and a profound understanding of the material you're going to play with. Because it's a little bit, like, I guess, like art. Before you break rules in art, you need to understand art. And it's a little bit like that for me too. It's like you need to become like, maybe not like the biggest expert on earth on the subject, but you need to have a strong understanding of what you're playing with and what is the core essence of that. And if you understand what it is through different words or key sentences and things like that, then now when you start to brainstorm, you understand what you're trying to tap into. You understand what you're trying to achieve. And even like the vision for Guardians of the Galaxy, it was, if I remember well, it was boiled down to 6 words for what the game should taste like. I think it was fun, fast, and focused. And it was daring, dangerous, and deep. That's it. And I had a slide on PowerPoint. This is the vision for the game. And in the end, it's funny, in the last few weeks before it came out, we were playing the game, and I was with my gameplay director, and we were like, let's go back to our 6 words that we forgot from years ago. And like, is it fast? Yeah, it's kind of fast. Yeah, is it fun? Well, maybe I'm biased, but sounds like it's fun, you know. Is it focus? Yeah, it's not like we're not trying to do 3,000 things. We're doing this big story-driven adventure, and we focus on it. Is it daring? Yeah, we made some choices on that game that some players were like at the beginning, like WTF, what the hell is that? Why did you go in that direction? And the game is, I think, has big themes. Like, there's a lot of humor, but there's also a lot of drama, and there's a lot of things like that. So we were like, okay, we pretty much like kind of hit on those keywords. So we always, all that to say, that little story, to say that we're, we the keywords, key sentences to explain the essence of the franchise or to explain what we're trying to achieve as a team is super key for me. Because after that, when you work with people, like we were saying initially, it's a collaborative effort. Ideas come from the team as well. You need to understand your direction very thoroughly, because when people come with ideas, it can be sometimes those are great ideas and it can be very tempting to embrace them. But if they don't fit in what you establish in the first place, it could be a cause to make your boat go adrift instead of staying focused on the destination. So you have to have that. And if like we don't embrace an idea, there's a reason behind it. It's not because I'm the creative director, I don't like your idea, I don't care. That's not how I work. It's no, there's a reason why we're not going in that direction, because it doesn't tap into what we're trying to achieve here. So your idea is great, but maybe it's not for that direction. So that's the kind of mindset behind all of that.
Totally makes sense. I love the fact that you also use alliteration for your core values. That makes it easy to remember.
I was very happy with that, yes.
That's cool. I also want to share that, you know, I told our creative director on Spider-Man, Brian Intihar, and our story director, John Paquette, that I was talking to both of you, and they gave me some questions that they wanted me to ask. And Mary, you mentioned the research that the team and you did, reading comic books, watching the movies, et cetera. So how did you go about balancing what people loved about the movies, what people loved from the comics, and your own spin on the franchise? And Brian asked me to share this question with you because it's one of the things that we struggled with. So, or we didn't struggle with it, but it was one of the challenges that we had in front of us. So how did you tackle that?
I think it was by, like I said, by reading all the comics, you get a sense. One thing that was fascinating for me is that I knew the characters in the movie, and there are certain very strong tentpole things about those characters that we know that we need to keep. Like Drax is very literal in the movies, and that's how people know him. So we knew we needed that. But when you were reading the comics, we were seeing different interpretations within Marvel itself, and we started to see, well, Drax is actually very much a tactician in the games. He's much more than what we're seeing in the movies. And we started kind of picking and choosing what we liked about them ourselves. One of the things that I often try and do when I'm developing characters from an original standpoint is I try and figure out what are their core character traits. And I try to come up with four of them and make them all balanced. And even though these characters are established, I kind of went and retro did it and said, okay, what are those four characteristics for each of them? And so that kind of helped give us a good sense of what was the core, the essence of this character, and where we could then start expanding it into our universe to play with it. Once it was that, it then continues to develop, because then you're bringing on a group of writers. I work with a lot of writers, and they all kind of, by talking with each other, they have their versions of the characters, and then but we all kind of agree on who these characters are and what is their story in our universe. And then we go from there. And my role on the project is to make sure with all these diverse writers that they're getting in what they, their views, their whatever, but they're staying true and that the voice sounds like one.
That does sound like a constant balancing act.
It is. And one of the ways that we managed to do it within the writing team is we would, every Friday, we would have script reads for like 2 hours. I think, you know, there's like the standard studio beer time, and it's like, okay, let's grab the beers and let's go for 2 hours in a conference room and let's read each other's scripts. And we acted out the characters ourselves as we're doing it. The big rule is whoever wrote it cannot read their script. They have to hear everyone else read it out loud. And I think by doing that every Friday, it kind of got everyone laughing and joking, talking about these characters and basically embracing them for who they are. And that kind of helped a lot in maintaining a consistency across all of the scripts.
What a great technique. That sounds like a lot of fun.
It was. It was a lot of fun. Eventually, as the actors were involved, if they were shooting at the studio on a Friday, we're like, and they were done, we were like, hey, guys, come and join. And then the actors would actually come and read these first draft scripts that would eventually change. But then it was always fun because then we got to hear the actors doing it instead of us doing, you know, our terrible impression of Mantis or whatever. So it was. It ended up being a lot of fun. And we also would invite anyone from the team who wanted to be a part of it. Because I think it's very important to share that among everyone in the production.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, and I do have a lot of questions about the characters themselves coming up. But before going there, I wanted to share another question that Brian Indar asked me. He pointed out that when we started working with Marvel on Spider-Man, we knew that if we don't nail swinging in the game, nothing else in gameplay matters. So was there one thing that your team felt like it had to really deliver on the Guardians experience?
Yes. The interaction between the characters, that dynamic between all of them. And because the fantasy we had in mind is like, because you play Star-Lord, it was like to hang out with the Guardians. And you needed to feel that you were hanging out with them at any given time, that they would feel alive, that you will constantly feel their presence around you. So since the beginning, when we decided on the direction, it was that thing. And as Mary was saying, like developing the characters and starting to develop the scripts and everything, it was always about making sure that the Guardians are always part of a scene. Like, it's not just Star-Lord and a character, but it's the five characters. Mm-hmm. When you're in traversal, having those four characters around you in combat as well, like in other different situations in the game. So those were the core aspect, like, that we needed to... You play a slice of this, and it feels like a Guardians of the Galaxy game, not a Peter Quill game. Mm-hmm. And it feels like the relationship and the dynamic between the team is constantly there and palpable. So that was the thing. That was our web sliding.
It really comes through. And I got to say kudos on the main characters. I mean, to me, and Mary, you've already alluded to this, they really stood apart from their movie counterparts without being totally different or alien. It was almost like, to me at least, you were sort of in this parallel universe where you saw them, you could see, you know, variations of them. And in particular, Drax. Wow. Drax was fantastic. I mean, he was my favorite character. He was consistently awesome. And I thought Quill was also constantly likable without being cheesy. So, you know, because I think that's an easy trap to fall into for any character, right? When you're talking about humor. So with all of that in mind, did you set any explicit goals for the dialogue up front?
Not necessarily, not consciously. I think one of the big concerns that I had going into the project was, we have to be funny. Oh my God, how are we going to be funny? And that was like the most terrifying thing from my perspective. But in handling that, we just knew, well, the humor of these characters is going to come from them being insanely dedicated to who they are. They're just always going to be who they are regardless. And so nailing that and nailing who these characters were, I think helped us to get the funny in there, get the humor in there and stuff. So that was it. And other than that, it was always, well, I think we always had to make sure there were a couple things that we had to keep in mind. We had to keep in mind, we don't want Gamora to be murder mom. So, you know, because you got a whole bunch of these misbehaving boys. I mean, Rocket is pretty, you know, Rocket's always Rocket and Drax is always literal and Groot is always indecipherable as I am Groot. And you don't want to always have Gamora being the one who's saying, guys, we got to do this, or Peter, you know. And so we had to find a balance for her was a big one. And another big rule that I always had to the writers was, if you're writing Groot in, you have to, in parentheticals, say what he is actually saying. And Rocket's line has to give you an understanding of that, which was often one thing I was always catching them on, because a lot of times you throw an I'm Groot, and then he was like, yeah, but what did he say? I have no idea what he said. So make sure that Rocket's answer is translating him without translating him.
I will say, I really liked how you did that in the game, because I felt like I was always kind of expecting a player, one of the characters, to help me understand what Groot was saying. But I thought you did it in a way that didn't feel ever feel on the nose. There was a lot of nuance that the other characters imparted to what Groot was saying, and it always kind of matched sort of Groot's inflections well. So yes. that was super cool.
And I actually think the actor who played Robert Montcalm, who plays Groot, did an amazing job as well, because he told me afterwards, he was like, having the parentheticals really, really helped me because now I know what I'm supposed to be saying. And I can get that across through my body language and through my facial expressions and through how I am saying I am Groot. And it really does work. I mean, when there are many times I've seen people play the game streamers and they're like, I swear he's saying this right now. I don't care. This is what he's saying. Yeah. And it works. It really worked.
That's cool. Well, you mentioned humor and I want to dig into that a little bit. How do you determine if something is really funny or if it's falling flat? Especially if you're the writer, if one is the writer of the line.
I think our script reads helped a lot in that. I think the constant going back with our review process, like the writers would write scripts. They might be seeking from the other writers advice and stuff, and they might get jokes from they might throw out a joke and then another writer would say, oh, that's funny, but try this. And then there was a lot of that. And then it would come to me and I'd be looking at it. And so sometimes you just know because you're reading it and I would be caught. I would just like laugh out loud at a line. It was so unexpected. But it is this constant thing that you're never 100% sure, especially when you're hearing it again and again and again. So some of it is just hope. And some of it is the talent of the writers. Yeah. They're phenomenal.
And I think also when it came about, the humor is even us as a team, when we understood that because the first few scripts to try to find the voice, sometimes like jokes were forced in. And with the jokes being forced in, it didn't necessarily work super well. And we said, like Mary was describing, like we come with traits for all the characters. But even one other thing that Mary does with the group and everything that she didn't speak about, it's like what this character like or dislike about this other character, and what is this? What are the things that makes certain characters closer or more distant, and all those points of tension or closeness. And the first few scripts were maybe a little bit too forced, but we were just trying to figure out the voice of all those characters. And what happened is like, no, the humor, they are not trying to be funny. They are themselves. They're just being who they are at 100%. And when they're facing different situations, they will have a reaction that is genuine to their core. And since there are very eclectic characters from different backgrounds and different ideals or thoughts or experiences in life, then that makes the clash or the fun comes from them just staying true to who they are, no matter what the situation is, no matter if it's a light situation or a very heavy situation. They're just genuine. And they're very different. So the humor comes a lot from that. And once as a team and the writers and everybody in the team started to understand it better, that, oh, we need to embrace it. And that from that point of view, things started to come way more naturally as opposed as, oh, we need to be funny here. And it's funny because after getting that and starting to review a lot of scripts, and sometimes Mary and I would discuss when we were reviewing the scripts, and I was saying to Mary, okay, here we still try to force a joke, it doesn't work, like let's play it naturally. And Mary, she I agree, and then she was talking with the writers, and then we were tweaking and iterating and everything, but it came from that place, just let go and let the character be themselves. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're not trying to be smartasses. Yep. They're not trying to wisecrack. They're just literally saying what they think and not recognizing how what they are saying can be interpreted by others. And that ultimately is the key to it.
That's a great approach. Now that you're saying that, it makes a lot of sense. I wasn't thinking that when I was playing. I was just sort of in the moment. But that's a great technique. And it leads to a question, another question that I got from John Paquette, who's our story director on Spider-Man. He pointed out that the banner during gameplay is fantastic. And it felt fun. It didn't impinge on the experience. And he wanted to ask you, you know, how much rewriting did you all do in order to get to that level of polish that, you know, you feel when you're playing and all four characters are talking and they're not stepping on each other. What they're saying actually fits together like a really clever puzzle. Now, did that take a long time? A lot of tries?
Well, it's a process that actually is more than just the writing. So yes, we did write multiple drafts of scripts. We implement those scripts immediately through text-to-speech in the game. Mm-hmm. So like the sooner we can get it in and see how it's sounding, even though you're hearing the terrible robot voices, you're getting a sense of it. Then we are rewriting and fixing the WAV files and getting them back in and doing that as we're developing it. So we went through multiple iterations of the scripts. Then we record, and then we have to adjust everything because the recording length doesn't necessarily fit either. And then it goes all the way into the final well after the writers are, most of the writers are off the project. We had what we called it a loco banter team. So it was the team in charge of making sure that the move, you know, the characters moving through the game were animating correctly and were speaking and were doing the placement, like Drax might go over the vending machine. They're doing all that, but they were also my lead writer was heavily involved in that group. And they were then even editing with the WAV files we had, not changing a WAV file, but like we might have had a 6-line joke. And it's like, you know what, this doesn't work. So we're tightening it up even as he's seeing the experience in game. And potentially even discovering, oh, shoot, we need something else. And we're searching through all those WAV files to find the great reaction from Peter or from whoever that can fill a space perfectly. So a lot of it was really crafted. It was just the real crafting of it that kind of just constantly fine tuning as we go.
Yeah. Well, that's cool to hear. And that sort of leads to a big topic. And that's the combination of design and story. Right? That seems so important for any narrative game today. So going back to the very beginning of the production, how do you approach macro design and story? Do you do one and before the other? How do you make that all work?
Well, it's we have several things. Once we know a bit what is the game fantasy or the player fantasy we're going for and what kind of experience we have in mind. So we start the design in terms of how certain of the mechanics are going to work together. But in parallel, we're going to start to work on the story. And the story we're trying to really flesh out high level. What is the adventure? What's at stake? And what are the guardians are fighting? And the big drama. And then eventually we develop a skeleton for it with story beats. And then we go in a big process that we call the blueprint. And that process, we sit in a room for 2 or 3 months, depending on the scope of the game or the challenges that come with what we're doing. And basically we're trying to give life to the skeleton of the story. We know that, okay, this is the starting point. This is the initial incident, like in our case, releasing the entity at the beginning in the quarantine zone. Like there, at that time, you don't know it's the Magus, but you unleash it. So we build the adventure that leads to that. We're, okay, what are the goals here? Well, it's the beginning of the game. You need to get the gist of like using your guns, Peter, and then you need to understand the Guardian's request system with Rocket, with Groot, and progressively, and boom, 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 boom. And then, okay, next chapter, what is it about? Okay, it's the everyday in the Guardian's life. Okay, what does it mean? So we create an adventure with that, like the monster that they have to sell to Lady Hellbender. So basically what we have a big Excel sheet in which like we go, what is the story goal? What is the gameplay? What are the gameplay goals here? All these things. And boom, boom. So we put it in the Excel sheet and we build like block one of gameplay. Peter goes into, I don't know, like he opens the box on the Meredith's bed. Okay, boom, that's that. What's in this room? What's the show don't tell? What are these things? What are the animations? Is there music? Is there not? And we have a massive Excel sheet from the entire game from start to finish on paper. So now we can give it to the production team and they can look at it and scope from what they understand from that. Oh, I think too many environments, to this or to that. And we can already readjust the scope without having to cut an entire level that has not been built yet. So it's efficient in that respect. And eventually, when that is solid, I worked with a storyboard artist, and we did a version of the blueprint that was all drawings for the entire game, and I was putting it in a PowerPoint with links for choices and consequences, so you could play it on paper and decide you sell Groot or Rocket, and you click, and it was leading you to the next vignettes of drawings, that what was the adventure if you sold Groot or if you sold Rocket and stuff like that. And then I was presenting it to the team. I flew to Marvel in LA to present. I think I presented to Bill and Eric like for over 6 hours in one day, the entire adventure on paper. And I said, that's what we're going to build. Yay or nay.
And what I love about the blueprint process, the initial Excel sheet, it's like up until then, you've got a story. Because we've worked out story beats, we've worked out the plot, we have our main beats, and we know the characters and everything. But it's a story told from a storyteller's point of view. The blueprint turns it into a game that is being experienced through a player's experience of it. So you would find things like yes, I had no idea that we were going to throw in, like in my initial story, I didn't know that we were going to throw in the telephone gameplay of trying to get the world mind its attention. I just knew that we're going to go see the world mind and we have to somehow convince the world mind to hear us out. But the blueprint turned around and made it into an actual game that is experienced through the player. Of course, that Excel sheet, a lot of people look at it and they're like, what? And they're like, you want, huh? And so what I think, and we've had the blueprints on the Deus Ex games before, but this was the first time with JF coming up with the illustrated blueprint. That made a huge difference to the team, I think, because finally most people, they're like, yeah, blueprint, whatever. I don't want to look at it. I don't want to deal with it. Only the people who needed to scope really understood it. But this made the game understandable to everybody on the team.
That sounds great. Cool concept and approach. So Jean-Francois and Mary, you both talked about a little bit about scope. You both mentioned scope a bit. And once you're going in production, how often do you reevaluate scope?
It feels like all the time.
We reevaluate the scope as needed. And like Mary said, like it, oftentimes because like there are the estimates, there's the actual work, and there's always a discrepancy between the estimates and the actual work. Sometimes we overestimate the time it will take for sometimes, and a lot of time we underestimate, or sometimes we stumble into issues that we didn't foresee, and now suddenly you have to have different discussions, different conversations. And sometimes too, is especially when we're in the middle of production, like we all know, we're all stressed. We have like 3,000 things to manage at once. And sometimes some people get anxious more than other easily. And some like, there's no way we can do that. We need to cut. And sometimes you have to keep yourself very cold and analyze the situation. Like, am I in face of something that needs to be cut? Or it's more someone that right now is nervous because there's a lot and maybe there's support that is needed instead of cutting and things like that. So you go through all these things in order and or in disorder. And but there are some times we go, for example, there's one scene we build when the Guardians visit Lady Hellbender. To sell Groot and Rocket. At the end, like no matter what you do, you have to defeat the Dweller in Darkness, and the Guardians jump on the hover bikes, and boom, the cutscene. They get to the Milano, and hey, they go away. That hover bike scene was playable from start to finish with monsters running after you and Lady Hellbender, and you had to avoid stuff and everything. And we had a prototype of it that was not as advanced as we love to. When came the time, you know what, some of our production managers and said, JF, like, if we do that, like, there's a shitload of other things that we won't be able to pull off. So this one, like, it doesn't look good. And with Mary and other people, we discuss it. But the beauty with the blueprint we were talking about, and now with the illustrated blueprint, it makes the game so tangible on paper that when it's time to cut, it's not that it's easy to cut, but because you have a clear understanding of what you're trying to achieve, you're able to pinpoint the places that, oh my God, it's great, but the story and the game experience works without it. And we can have the discussion. It opens the discussion up with the manager. So if I cut this, like, am I helping you to finish other things? Yes, or it's enough, or it would be perfect, or it's not enough, or da 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 da. And we go like that. So, and we're able, our goal is always, we always said, like, even on the Human Revolution, Mary and I, at some point, the managers tells us, you need to cut 25% of the game scope. And we're like, I want to scream. But you take a deep breath, and we went in the room with Mary, and we look at what we had. And it's funny, because the cuts we made on Human Revolution, when the final game came out, it doesn't show at all. And moreover, when we did the Missing Link, the DLC that came with it, because it was connecting so well with what we already built, players were convinced that we cut it from the main game, which was not true at all. Like, we came with that story late in the development cycle of Human Revolution. It was almost finished when we came up with that idea. And it's just that because we have that blueprint, it gives us a great understanding of what we're making. And the same with Guardians. So there are few cuts in Guardians, but when you play the game, you don't feel them. Because we make sure to work pieces out that will help the production in a way that maintains the integrity of what we're working on. But if we didn't have that process that we talked at length, it would be harder, because we wouldn't have the same deep understanding of what we're trying to build. And probably we could make cuts that on the moment would feel right, but later down, Mary and I and some other would go, oh my God, like, we didn't think about this or that. And now suddenly we'd have a bigger problem to manage.
That makes sense. And I guess for both of you, because, you know, scoping is a part of every production today, given how big the games are that everybody's making, you know, how do you allay fears that the game isn't going to get done, or something is just too difficult? What are some of the techniques that you as leaders use to help your team see things differently?
That's a really good question. Sometimes I think I'm still learning how to deal with that and how to manage, because a lot of it is, I think it comes back to something JF was saying, is that understanding where the anxiety is coming from for the individual. And so sometimes it's a matter of saying, guys, you know, you've got to trust me. You've got to trust us. Sometimes it's a matter of directing them, like, forewarning sometimes. Like, what was great with the blueprint was we could see ahead that certain things might be difficult. So I was able to kind of focus the writing team on that and say, guys, okay, look, if that's what we're doing, what could happen if we have to cut it, you know, or how, what are the solutions and things? And then getting them working as a team already ahead of time to expect it. Sometimes that helps. Other than that, it's a constant day-to-day, you know, individual struggle to make sure everyone is their morale stays high, that they're passionate and dedicated to this, and that you can kind of alleviate. And also a lot of it comes down to the basic thing is we don't know. We're just hoping, we're crossing our fingers and hoping. And, And you have to kind of get that across too and say, you know, it's okay if it comes to it, we'll figure out a solution. Don't worry about it right now. Just focus on what's in front of you.
And I think another thing, it's very early in the project, is from my perspective, one of my beliefs is that I cannot look you in the eye and sell you a game that I don't believe I can pull off. It's as simple as that. It's if it's too ambitious, if it's too crazy, if it goes beyond, even me, I won't believe in it. So if I don't believe in it, how am I supposed to ask a big team to believe in it? It's impossible. But if I believe it can be pulled off, and when I say being, I believe it can be pulled off, I'm not talking about staying in the comfort zone. I'm talking about being ambitious over the line of comfort zone, because I believe we do our best work when we're scared. If we're not scared, we're getting lazy. And so it's a fine line between putting yourself in danger, but in danger, a danger that is manageable, and a danger that when we meet or we face hurdles with the team, you don't just say, figure it out. You go and you sit down with the people and you figure it out together. It's not their problem. It's our problem as a team. But I believe we can achieve it. I think we can do it together. And we have a little bit of experience and everything. So it helps us sometimes, like Mary was saying, that some situations are very reminiscent to different situations in the past that we had to manage. And sometimes, like, what was true back then is still true today. So you develop little tricks, or sometimes you just breathe when it's not time to panic. We just have to look at these things coldly and go forward. But I think that the key is really, example, Guardians of the Galaxy, when I went to present the game in front of my upper management, and then when I went to Marvel to present it, if I didn't believe we could pull it off, if I didn't believe it was exciting, if I didn't believe it was ticking the boxes that we believe it was, I wouldn't be presenting it. We would still be working on it until we get to that point. So we need to be careful between, like, especially early in your career, when we start as designers, we want to do everything and we're, oh my God, it's going to be great, 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 great. And then life happens, you meet walls, like you understand a lot of things early on in your career, and oh, I'm overtly ambitious here, overtly ambitious there. So now we're able to do that, especially with the processes that we have, that gives us a comfort in what we're building. And the way we build it, it gives us the flexibility, if we went still a bit overboard, to pull back a bit without compromising the game. So I would say it's all those things, but it starts with you believing that you can pull it off.
Well, that's a sounds like a fantastic philosophy, and I'm sure it comes through in all the presentations you have to make, right? Because you're convincing team members, yes, stakeholders, Marvel. And so one of the key components that I have a lot of questions about, just in terms of how you presented it, was combat. Because, mm-hmm, you know, four character combat in a high action game is a lot to pull off.
Yeah.
So did your vision for combat evolve as from beginning to the end?
Oh yeah, definitely. It was, the high level philosophy never changed, in the sense we wanted to make you feel as the player that, you were using your guardians in combat while they were autonomous at the same time, and most importantly, still feel alive. Not just, it's not like stories happening. Oh, here's gameplay mechanics. Screw the story. Story will come back later. No, it needed to continue. So all these things from the beginning, those were clear, and that never changed. It just took us many years to to make it happen and find the real fun in that. But at the beginning, Peter was supposed to be more cover-based, shooting from afar. Guardians, as you were sending them with the request system, you were seeing Drax run on the battlefield to go to the enemy. But since the battlefield evolves quite fast, by the time that Drax gets, let's say, to the enemy you pointed out, maybe Gamora already killed that enemy, or you did as a player, and now Drax was there, like, doing nothing, not knowing where to go or what to do and stuff like that. And we were like, oh my God, like, it's not gelling, it's not this, it's not that. Then eventually we said, we need to teleport the characters so they can instantly do their things. And then, but we need to hide those pop-ups of Drax's ears disappears and then appears there. It's so ugly. So now we add those mini kind of cinematics where you see Drax in action doing his thing, and it was hiding the teleportation. But again, it gets repetitive. It gets the same thing over and over again. It pulls you out of the action and stuff like that. And one day, I think it's one of the designers, I can't remember exactly, but someone on the team decided to remove those vignettes because it was controversial in the team, and we were, no, it's there for a reason. And then one day, I'm playing the build, and the vignettes are gone, but me, I'm playing like usual, and I don't, like, blink or anything. I'm playing, yeah, it's cool, like, now Drax does this, and then, yeah. And then, wait a second, something's missing. The vignettes are gone, and the characters are just popping from one position to the next position for their attacks. And suddenly, like, what we thought was a big deal that, oh no, we cannot leave that like that because it will be ugly. No, nobody cares. Nobody realizes it. And what you need, and even when you have experience, sometimes you fall in those traps, like thinking, oh, it won't be pretty, it won't be realistic and everything. No, players, when they press the button, they want the action to do what it has to do right now, in the moment. And it's so simple. Everybody will go, yeah, of course it's like that. But sometimes when you're in the creative process of building something that doesn't really exist like the way you envision it, sometimes you get trapped in those kind of train of thoughts that don't bring you where it needs to bring you. So we went through many iterations like that until, like, we freed ourselves. Yes, Gamora jumps super high in the sky. She slashes the enemy. Oh, it looks cool. It's fun. It's more like, it's more in the Marvel kind of like a spectacle and everything. And us coming from Deus Ex, where everything has to be justified and realistic or at least believable and everything, like, a part was discovering the fun for the combat with those five characters, and the other part was us deprogramming ourselves from what we did for a decade. And all those things were part of the equation. The other thing, it was, how do we create a sense that even when you're not asking guardians to do things on the battlefield, how do they feel as they battle? Like, do they feel alive? Do they need to have choreography? Like, we needed to build the AI systems and bubbles in which, like, you have a bubble, enemies, and let's say with Gamora, what makes her go to the next bubble of enemies or things like that. We had many systems that sometimes a part of the system was making the game suck, basically, and sometimes it's just like readjust how those systems speak to each other, that now we were finding the balance where, okay, Gamora goes there, she stays with those enemies for a while, and if there's not too much threat there, then she can go to the next bubble. But also it depends with what the player does. If the player stands back, or does the player attract the aggro or not, and we had to build in also things like, if you stay engaged with your guardians, they will be more efficient, they will stay alive longer. If you pull back and you stay afar and you don't get engaged as much, they will fall on their knees more easily and everything. And we also had to adjust, like, the range of shooting to make sure that players stay within a certain range for efficiency and being engaged with the guardians. But, like, today we have a list of all these things that we could send to you guys and go, hey, here's that. But, like, all the years it took us to figure out all those little details. And after that, the voiceover work, like you were talking about the local banter, all the chat that they have as they walk, but also all the things they say during combat that speaks to feedback to the player, but also continue to make the story continue, so to speak, like make it feel that the story is still alive, like it didn't stop abruptly. And when all those pieces came together, okay, now so we add something, like, is it perfect? No. Is it still chaotic a bit? Absolutely. But we found the recipe and we were like, okay, now we have solid foundations.
Well, it is absolutely unique. I mean, it was, I wasn't expecting to have such, you know, that approach when I started the game, you know, being able to tell all my buddies what to do. And I agree that what you ended up with in terms of the instantaneous nature of seeing your partners carry out attacks was great. I mean, from a gameplay perspective, it felt really good. But I also, Mary, I want to just give kudos to you and your team. That combat dialogue is really, really helpful. I mean, in terms of letting you know what's going on and what you need to think about, it was great. I mean, really well thought out. And not repetitive. Not repetitive. Yeah. That was the other big plus.
It does get repetitive at some points, unfortunately. And that's just a matter of not enough variation. But there were... getting that banter right, it was a combination of different systems, because you're dealing with the systems that are telling you, you know, the typical bark system where it's like they're giving you the feedback, but we're also building in this little banter system where we would write custom lines from one character and have like call outs for every single character, so the system could randomly put those dialogues together. And we would have to make those banters. We'd always, so every single fight drew on a pool of systemic dialogues that lasted through the whole game. And maybe at some of the later fights, we could pull out some of the barks and add new ones just to help with the progression of the story. But also every fight had to have custom banter, because the custom banter between them was important to keep you in the story and to keep you, you know, knowing that who are they fighting at this time? What is their thought pattern against the story in the story at this time, and how is it going? So it was a bit crazy on that side for us to write it all, but and that's why, yeah, I mean, I think it does add so much to the combat. You always wish you could tweak a little more. You always wish you could do a little bit more so that you don't constantly hear. But also, like, I think one of the fun things that we discovered through that is one of the character traits of Gamora, because when we were writing those barks for her, the writer who was writing them was kind of giving her bad puns, you know, and it was like, these are bad puns. They're really bad. Knife to see you and stuff like that. And it's like, but you know what? Maybe that's a huge part of her story. And then when we discovered that, we were then able to write that into some of the dialogues you can have with her to discover why she tells bad puns and how it became a competition between her and Nebula in their past in order to kind of distance themselves from the murders they were doing. So even that, it all just kind of fed each other.
That's well, you since you mentioned lines of dialogue, I'm sure you remember the days when we were writing 1,000 lines of dialogue for a game. So how can I ask how many lines of dialogue exist in this game?
You can ask, and if I could remember, I would tell you. But I just know it's huge. It's like, I mean, it's no joke. They never stop talking.
It's way over 200,000.
Wow. That's impressive.
It's crazy. Yeah, the scripts we reviewed, like the Bibles, were thick, and we were spending days just reviewing text. And it's funny because there was so much that once it was recorded and integrated in game, sometimes there were months in between the review and that happening, and we were discovering those lines in the game, not remembering we reviewed it, and we were starting to laugh at, oh my god, that's crazy, like feeling like you hear it for the first time. But that was quite it was quite something.
Wow. That actually happened to me when I replayed the game recently. I'm like playing it and I'm like, wait, did I improve that joke? Oh man, I can't believe I improved that joke. And just forgetting that certain things were in there.
Large. Well, one of my favorite parts, I'm sure I've seen this in reviews and other and player comments. One of my favorite parts about combat is the huddle. When you trigger huddles, it's super cool. So when did that come in as a concept during production?
It's at the beginning, after when we start the conception for the game, early on, like Mary was saying, reading a lot of books, and we get like acquainted with the source material and the core values. Blah, blah, blah. And once we have a fairly good understanding of where we go with the game, we start to brainstorm, okay, but as a player, what do you do? And with the guardians, and like, what are the abilities? And we go with post-its on the wall and everything. And one day, remember, I wrote huddle. And I said, somehow, like American football, I would see like the five guardians come together for some sort of reason. But I had no clue whatsoever what that meant. And we put that sticker on the wall. And my gameplay director and I was like, there's something with the huddle. We need to pursue it. And my gameplay director was like, I hear you, JF, right? But right now I have no flarking idea what to do with it. And as we started to develop the combat system and the interaction or the dynamic between the AI characters and the player characters and all the things we talked a bit about earlier started to come together. Now suddenly that something was missing, kind of a ace in the hole kind of thing that would spice the combat. And huddle came back on the surface again, like, okay, how can we use that huddle? But at that point, it was still, I have no idea. And the audio director and one of the game designer on the team, they said it should be linked to music in some capacity. And they presented me their high-level pitch, and I got super excited because since Peter Quill, like, music is a big part of the character and everything, and in the game we have the licensed tracks, we have the Star-Lord band that is his favorite band, hence the name Star-Lord, things like that. But we didn't have a way to include music in gameplay, and that was the... We saw the opportunity there. So the sound designer, the sound director and the game designer, they fleshed it out. They came up with the concept like of you boost like the, it's kind of the Jerry Maguire, so to speak, like speech, like the guardians come to you. They're either depressed or too cocky, and you have to decipher like their mood and decide what speech to give and everything. And the idea is that since Peter, like he loves to charm people. He loves to bring people with him and everything, but he's a bit awkward. He doesn't have always the right words and everything. So for him, what about making it linked to the music and the lyrics? Like his speeches, like he just base it loosely from the lyrics he knows from the songs he knows. And that's how he delivers those motivational speeches or fail to do so. And that's how it started to happen during production. And after that, with Mary, Steve, and some other writers started to build all those speeches for the huddle, because now it's complicated because it plays random. And you can have a song that in a situation will be a lose because depending of the situation on the battlefield, but another situation on the battlefield, the same song can be on the win side. And therefore, like you need to match the speeches so it can fit in different orders. And there are moments in the game where one or two or more guardians are not in the team. So therefore you need to write some of those that they can only play in those circumstances, because writing all the speeches for all the songs with all the characters and just some characters, it would be endless. And already what we had to do, Mary and I had a couple of evenings with a bottle of wines and a lot of writing and rewriting.
Yeah, the huddles did end up going through several iterations because some of it was like it has to mirror the license, but the song, it has to be like recognizable as it's that song. But then it was like, well, no, we're going to get into copyright issues if it's too much mirroring it. So then it has to be taken back of stuff. And then it was like, well, no, but now it has to go in this direction. So they went through multiple versions. Right down to the 11th hour, to get them in there and stuff. But it is exciting to see it. And it's exciting to see the reaction that players have had to it.
Well, I'm kudos to you also for giving players a choice in the huddle, right? And having to really pay attention to what his teammates are saying. I thought that was great. It made me feel like I was actually having an impact on what was going to happen next.
It comes back when you understand your fantasy and playing as the so-called leader. If you have that moment and you don't have that choice, it lessens your fantasy of being the so-called leader.
Yeah.
So that helped to reinforce that in some respect.
Totally. And so music, right? Music is, man, I was a teenager in the 80s. And so all the songs you picked were just like a trip backwards. And I'm sure that's the same for a lot of your audience too. But given that maybe I'm not your target audience because I'm in my 50s and you have a lot of younger members on your team, I imagine, did you have to educate any of your team members on some of these bands? Like, for example, when I heard the first synth chords for Turn Me Loose by Loverboy, I knew exactly what song that was because I remember listening to that album again and again. Do your team members know those songs? Did you have to have listening sessions with everybody?
Actually, when the list was built, maybe I didn't witness everything, but I only remember people on the team being very excited about the songs that were chosen. I remember people coming with their own ideas. Oh, it would be cool this or that, and sometimes, of course, with getting the rights and things, you don't always get 100% what you want to get. But I just remember people on the team being really excited. Our audio director was sharing some of the secure songs here and now. And as soon as a new Star-Lord song was written, we were sharing it with the team. And I just remember people being just excited by the variety and going back that memory lane. And I think even the younger people on the team too, it was somehow they either knew those songs or they thought those songs were good if they discovered them. So no, I think it was a fairly positive. I think the only tricky question I got once, it was in a trip to LA to some of our buses, and someone asked, do you think kids today will care for those songs because they're old songs? And our answer was, well, Peter grew up in the 80s, and it's about the fantasy. It's not about whether the kids today like it or not. And the other thing, it was, a good song is a good song. And I watched the 7 hours of the Beatles Get Back Together thing, Peter Jackson thing. And I watched it from start to finish and I was riveted. And those are songs from the 60s. And they still play today and they inspire musicians across the world. So,
well, yeah, they've really, you guys picked some great, great songs. I mean, iconic and true. They are just awesome songs. You also made a lot of great music. The Star-Lord band I thought was seriously authentic sounding, and kudos to your lead singer. Who's the lead singer for that band?
I've been talking about my audio director for the last few minutes. It's him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
He's awesome.
Yeah. It's Mary, correct me if my memory is faulty, but I think early on in the beginning of the project, when we were starting to design the characters visually, the question was Peter is known as Star-Lord. Mm-hmm. Why is he called Star-Lord? What's the origin of it? In the movie, the movies, they have their thing. But us, for our game and our vision for the characters, what's our thing? And it's one of the concept artists on the team that he came one day, said, what if Star-Lord is his favorite band? And my eyes lit up because, like you, I'm a kid of the 80s. My favorite band was Iron Maiden and still is to this day. And I had long hair. I had my jean coat with cut sleeves, and I had my patch of Somewhere in Time Iron Maiden with my studs. Basically, young Peter is I took a page of my own life for that beat, and I was like, oh my God, it's a great idea, it's great, and he has his patch and everything, and I'm like, okay, but we need to be authentic, like you just said, like. So if we say in the game that Star-Lord is his favorite band, it means that the music needs to exist. Otherwise, it's just like we say things, but we don't mean them. And I went like, what if we create this band and we write the music? And I go to Steve Tchaikovsky, our audio director, and I ask him like, do you feel, because I know he's a guitarist singer in a cover band, like on Friday nights, Saturday nights, they go around Montreal and they play some gigs and everything. And I said, would you be interested? And it was like, his eyes lit up and he was like super excited. So I speak to my producer. I say, hey man, we have this great idea for Star-Lord and but I need money and And he says, okay, JF, like I give you the money to write and record one song as a proof of concept. And if it works, then we'll pursue it. And because I said, we cannot just write a song, we need a full album. Because Peter is a fan of Star-Lord and he listens to it in his bed, and we need the full album. And so Steve goes, disappears, does his thing, comes back, he gives me the headset. I start to listen to it, and it was, I think it was Space Riders. And I'm like going like this, wow, that's catchy, it's cool. It starts to sing, like, singer's great. Like, and I said to Steve, who's singing? And he looks at me, says, it's me. And he goes, yeah, but it's me for the demo. I'm thinking we're going to get the singer when, if that thing moves forward and everything. I said, no. We already found our singer. I said, you just keep it the way it is right now. And we send it to the team, and the team fell in love with the song and everything. Yeah. And that's how it got greenlit to write a full album. I presented it to Marvel. Marvel like was excited with it and everything. And it was really fun. But it was out of passion of trying to be authentic, trying to find something original for Peter that is ownable, that is not a copy of another medium or what, that is our own thing. But it started with an idea from one of our concept artists, and then us being crazy enough to embark on that journey and write the lyrics, the songs, record everything. So, yeah.
The lyrics are great too. Mary, did you and your team write those lyrics?
No, they were all Steve.
Really?
Oh, yeah, man. They were all Steve.
Yeah, that's
cool. He did the thing. And I know, I mean, I didn't talk to him too much about him, but I know that he was basing a lot of them on he knew the themes of the game, and he knew the theme of Star-Lord and the journey of the Guardians. And so many, many of the lyrics were reflective of the journey that the Guardians go through. But that was all Steve.
Well, clearly, when Eidos Montreal has its next holiday party, you've got your band set, right? So you have to go outside. It's great.
He's ready.
That is awesome. Well, I wanted just to conclude by asking you all a couple of just questions about, just overall questions about the project. And maybe it's an opportunity to offer advice to other developers. So, for both of you, what are a few of the things that you learned on this project that you plan to repeat on your next projects?
For me, it was definitely, I already mentioned the script reads that we did. We instituted that for the first time on this project. And I was totally blown away at how much it brought to the game. It brought the creative team, the writing team became their own, they're the found family of it. They're the misfits who all kind of grew together and became very, very close and collaborative through that. So I would definitely institute that again, for sure, to have that kind of thing. I think what I learned the most on this is to trust the writers and to throw things at them that normally in the past I'd be like, oh, maybe I should figure this out first and figure out, but to actually just throw it at them and then hear them and get back. So I would definitely institute a lot of that. JF, if you have some answers, I'll try and think of more while you're adding yours.
And it's okay to share things that you wouldn't do on the next project too. So.
I think, like Mary said, like we work with a bunch of passionate people, and today I'm way more comfortable with myself. And when I say today, like in my journey, in my career, to embrace the ideas of others. Like when you're young, you're more insecure, you're more you want to prove yourself, you want this, you want that. But as you grow older, and I will join you in the 50s in 2 weeks from now. So yeah, we're all in the same kind of ballpark.
I'm 29. I don't know what you're talking about.
And nowadays, it's more like what I learned even more in this project. I let people like run with ideas way more. Then I used to be very hands-on on a lot of things. I'm still am to a certain degree. I still have to be, but letting go and embracing the creative power of other people, as long as it stays within the direction that we have established in the beginning, I'm more than happy to let people prove themselves and showcase their talent. And one thing that I did learn on this project that I did more than any other projects is when people were coming to me with different ideas, sometimes even when the idea was in the right direction, I was like, you know, I'm not convinced, like the idea, there's something that but I'm like, you know what, you like your idea, you're convinced it will help us to make a better game, run with it. And we have the right to be wrong. And if you are wrong, we'll go in another direction. And if you are right, we all win. So just make it happen and we'll see. And I think I'm way more comfortable with that today than I was in the early stages of my career. And it doesn't, when you're a kid, you feel threatened. Today, I feel empowered. It's crazy like that. It's weird, and it makes me much more happy in that role, so to speak. The other thing is we discussed earlier is the illustrated blueprint. It helps to make it tangible and digestible for everyone on the team much more easily, and even someone that joins the team, like let's say 2 or 3 years in, there's a lot of backstory that they don't have, but going right away with the blueprint, they can already have a sense quickly in a few hours, that's the game we're making, this is where it's going, and they can ask questions and they can re-challenge things still, and we can have those healthy conversations. So yeah.
I think another thing we did that was very successful was we put together chapter teams. So we actually had writers embedded with level designers and level artists. And we would basically give them, I mean, we had the blueprint, they knew the chapter, they knew what they were going. We would present, this is the goals, this is what has to happen, here's the main story beats. But we let them, the chapter teams, kind of figure it out together. And they would have come back to us with ideas for gameplay, for story, for stuff like that. And I think it was very successful in that sense. Because at least, I mean, I know from a writing standpoint, a lot of times writers of games are complaining that they're left out of the process all the time and they're having to fix, you know, and they have to make sense of stuff that makes no sense. But by actually having them as a part of it, that kind of cut that off to some degree right away, because then they could be there, they could help foster these ideas, they could share and collaborate better. And I think it really made for some very strong stuff. And I think it's funny because there are a lot of things. I was talking to my lead writer the other day and they were like, there's a lot of things that got in the game that I know the writers were like, I can't believe those things got in the game. Like, I can't believe that the singing between Gamora and Peter, or the singing, this came from the team. This came from them. It wasn't from us. And And they're like, we just kept sitting there throwing these ideas at you guys and thinking at some point, Mary's going to cut it off, JS going to cut it off, or Marvel's going to cut it off. But nobody cut it off. It just kept. And they were like, I can't believe all this crazy, wacky stuff ended up in the game. And it all ended up because I think we had that philosophy of, you know, bring us your ideas and, you know, make them work and prove it.
That is fantastic. Well, thank you for sharing all of that. Those are good, really great lessons. And Mary, I'm glad you brought up the importance of collaboration between writers and designers, because right with the narrative driven game, it's so crucial that the writers and the designers feel like they're a team, right? And not competing. So that's super cool to hear. And it really shows in the game how tight that relationship is up there. So wow. Was there anything else, any last shots you want to share with our listeners?
Well, for my part, I would say that it's been a crazy ride, and seeing the reception and seeing people around the world playing it and being enthusiastic about it. And like, for a lot of people, it was one of their best games. Like, and even though it was coming, like, I didn't expect this one to be good, things like that. But still, it was super, super fun to see that people had fun. They were laughing, but some also almost cried. And I remember back in the days of PS2, if you remember, like, oh, it's the generation where now we're going to make people cry because everything will. And we were like, back then, I remember, how do you make people cry? Like, is there a recipe? You do this, and people cry? No, I think it's just, you just go with your guts. And when you embrace the material you play with, and you just like fall in love with it, and you just go with your heart, I think it helps. And seeing the reaction, for me, it's probably been the greatest reward. And this game, even though there were a little bit of bugs and things like that in the end, and it feels like it's the first game that has 80 that feels like 90 from my perspective. And it feels, I'm super happy. And, you know, it's thanks to the fan, really, because you've been great. And the love that we have received as a team is unparalleled.
Yeah, I can't really top that because I agree with everything JF said. So I'll just say, if you haven't played the game and you're going to hide the tech and lose, and if you like puppies, then you should not save Cosmo. That's all I'm going to say.
No spoilers. That's awesome. Cool. Thank you all so much for taking the time. It's been a lot of fun talking
to you. Thanks to you.
It's been fun.
Congratulations again on the game.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. And good luck with the upcoming Insomniac games. There's a lot on the plate, and I can't wait to play it myself.
Me too.
Right on. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.